This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Don't accounting firms who audit the books of entities such as the Coliseum in Bloomington have a responsibility to pick up theft and fraud? Fraud like that alleged against Central Illinois Arena Management?
The first question in my mind is, we need to understand how did the wrongdoer steal or embezzle the money? In a very detailed fashion, we need to understand that. And then depending upon the answer to that question, the duties of the accounting firm may or may not have been breached.
The attorney for the famously defrauded city of Dixon, Illinois, talks with GLT's Ryan Denham. And an international death with dignity advocate comes to the Twin Cities. Laura Kennedy tells us more. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There's been a lot of finger-pointing since prosecutors announced five former managers at the U.S. Cellular Coliseum were facing 111 criminal counts of theft, fraud, and money laundering. As taxpayers try to assess who's to blame for the alleged fraud, the City of Bloomington auditors face new scrutiny. After all, isn't it the accountant's job to find fraud? GLT's Ryan Denham talked to some experts and found the answer is not so cut and dried.
The most famous example of municipal fraud in Illinois was in Dixon, where City Treasurer Rita Crunwell stole $54 million over two decades. Devin Bruce was hired by the City of Dixon to investigate and pursue whether anyone responsible contributed to the theft.
After going through tens of thousands of pages of documents and working with consultants and experts from around the country, and after taking numerous depositions in our civil lawsuit, we were able to recover for the City of Dixon $40 million, keeping in mind that Rita stole slightly more than that. However, the U.S. Marshal's Office was able to sell a number of her assets and recoup city money for the city from a criminal standpoint. So, we went a long way in making the city whole for inadequacies and negligent conduct, we believe, of both the banks and most particularly the accounting firm that was responsible for performing the annual audit.
What can we learn, and what did you learn about the degree to which municipalities like Dixon rely on their auditors to protect taxpayer funds?
Excellent question. They should rely upon their auditors. These accounting firms are charging good money of taxpayers, ultimately, in order to perform annual audits. And as a part of the annual audit, part of that is to identify fraud and any inaccuracies that are contained in the city's finances. So that's part of their job duties and responsibilities according to general accounting standards. And the city pays for those audits to be done properly. So I guess the answer is yes, they do rely on it, and they should. I presume Bloomington doesn't have an army of internal accounting experts and auditors. That's why they hire presumably some outside auditors to do that. I have no idea, but that's the way a lot of cities are set up.
Do you think that city officials, elected officials, and even the general public have any kind of misconceptions about the rigorousness of external auditors like Clifton Larson Allen or other firms as they come into municipality? Did you see any of that as you were working on your case?
I think the general accounting standards are clear that, especially in 2017, the duty and responsibility of the accounting firms is to identify, when performing an annual audit, fraud and misstatement in the financial records. I think that municipalities expect that and believe that that's occurring. Now, whether or not the accounting firms are doing that is a whole different matter. And if you can look at it this way, keep in mind that you have a number of people on a city council or who is the city manager or the mayor of a given city that these people do not have years of training, college education, years of seminars to identify fraud and misstatement. And they're not paying to do that. They're hiring an outside accounting firm to do that. And that's their duty and responsibility, the accounting firm, to do that. And so are they, I guess the question that you're asking is, do municipalities rely upon accounting firms to perform that duty? I think the answer is clearly yes. And should they do so? I think the answer is clearly yes. The question that the city of Bloomington or any other city where some travesty of justice happens is, did the accounting firms do their job or not? And in your situation, I have no idea. I don't know. But that's the question that should be asked. And keep in mind, banks, in order to perpetuate this fraud, many times there's a fraudulent or false bank account or checks that are negotiated that shouldn't be negotiated. I've represented more than the city of Dixon as a municipality. I have other clients that have had this circumstance where you have embezzlement going on, and you have to look also at the banks. Did they follow their proper banking practices and procedures? And if they didn't, did that contribute to somebody stealing or embezzling money?
As the city of Bloomington tries to answer that question of did its accounting firm do its job as they hired it to do, how do you begin to determine that? Like, what are some of the early indicators and signs that they might see that would indicate in either direction, yes or no?
Certainly. So the first thing that I did with respect to the city of Dixon is, in order to understand whether or not some other cause of this contributed to the theft, and whether it be the accounting firm or a bank, the first question in my mind is, we need to understand, how did the wrongdoer steal or embezzle the money? In a very detailed fashion, we need to understand that. And then, depending upon the answer to that question, the duties of the accounting firm may or may not have been breached. But that's the first step, is to understand exactly how the money was stolen.
What can municipalities learn from your experience with Dixon and ultimately what happened? What should be their takeaway?
I think their takeaway should be that they should, as the city of Dixon did, be able to competently rely upon the accounting firms to do their job, which they're getting paid very well to do. This is not a charity. These accounting firms are getting paid very well to perform their auditing services. Okay, so I think from the city standpoint, you rely upon the accountants. Now, what can they do? One can discuss concepts of rotating accountants, okay, and best practices, depending on the circumstances, is for many times accounting firms to be rotated every several years, so that if you you don't have complacency, you need to have an arm's length transaction between the accounting firm doing the audit and the various individuals that are involved in the city or municipality's finances. You have to have that arm's length transaction. You have to have people that are really scrutinizing the numbers that they're looking at. And if you have an unhealthily good relationship between the accounting firm and those people responsible for the city finances, then that's where you can see circumstances where, that person, and we know him or her very well, and they don't scrutinize it because they know that person very well on a personal basis. So that's why more and more in modern times, the best practices are for accounting firms to rotate their accountants. And you say, well, is that the city's duty and responsibility? I would suggest to you it's not. I would suggest to you that it's the accountants who should be coming to their clients and say, hey, look, we've been working on this account for 4 years or 10 years. Best practices are for you to rotate your accountants. Now, for their best interest, many times that doesn't happen. But I do think that that's incumbent upon the accountants to tell their client that that's an option that they should pursue.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. That was Devin Bruce, the attorney hired by Dixon after its city treasurer stole $54 million over two decades. The city sued and later reached a settlement with its accounting firm, Clifton Larson Allen, and its bank, worth $40 million, for not doing more to stop the fraud. The city of Bloomington declined to comment on whether litigation against its own external auditor is under consideration in the Coliseum case. In recent years, the city of Bloomington's external auditor was Sikich. Bloomington paid Sikich, on average, around $152,000 a year from 2012 to 2016 to audit city finances and the Coliseum. In 2015, when prosecutors say the fraud scheme was still underway, the accounting firm Sikich did not find any problems with the Coliseum's financial reporting. That year, the city paid it $123,000. I asked Ed Seip from Illinois State University's Department of Accounting what role audits play for municipalities like Bloomington. He's an expert in financial reporting fraud and auditing techniques.
I think in your case, Ryan, you're talking about external auditors. And the whole purpose for an external auditor is to perform an examination and express an opinion as to whether or not the financial statements that the government, the city, the county, whatever, are prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, and whether or not those financial statements that they have prepared reflects the financial condition of the city or of the municipality in all material respects.
So whose job ultimately is it to protect against a fraud case like this? Is it that external auditor's job? Is it the city administration's job? Or really, is it a matter of we just kind of have to wait until someone's arrested?
Well, it's interesting that you should say should have to wait. In industry, for sure, and I suspect it's the same for governmental entities, the responsibility for fraud lies with management. Now, the auditors, as part of their review, will do some tests to see if internal controls are in place and whether or not they believe that they are operating effectively. But their job is not to detect fraud. Like I said, their job is to look at the financial statements and say, are they reasonably accurate? And when it comes to fraud, quite honestly, in most cases, finding cases of fraud is a matter of luck. In my situation, in all my years, I was involved in 3 fraud cases. One of them came to light because an employee anonymously reported his manager for stealing stuff. In the second case, it was a situation where an employee was stealing money. She got sick. She was off work for a week, and somebody else took over her job, said, something isn't right here. And when she came back, all heck broke loose.
So a few moments ago when you said ultimately the responsibility there lies with management, you're referring to, in this case, like city administration.
Yes, yes. And in that particular case, the ones that should be overseeing the reports, asking the questions, is management. Because, and like I said, in industry, management actually has to sign a letter that's part of the audit report that acknowledges that they are responsible for internal controls and that, to the best of their knowledge, the controls are in place and working effectively.
So speaking of internal controls, as recently as 2015, the city's external auditor, Sikich, audited the Coliseum's finances, and Sikich said in their report that year that, quote, we did not identify any deficiencies in internal control that we considered to be material weaknesses. That's what they wrote. What do they mean by that term, internal control? Can you kind of explain that in layman's terms?
Certainly. What internal controls are is that they are procedures and mechanisms that are put in place that are designed to prevent employees and other people from stealing, embezzling, or misappropriating assets. And they can be physical or they can be procedural. For an example, a physical control would be like, for instance, you go to a clothing store and you walk out of the clothing store and they forgot to remove that security tag on it and the alarms go off. Another example of a physical control would be having cameras over the cash registers so that they can detect whether or not employees are stealing money out of the cash drawer. Those would be examples of physical controls. An example of a procedural control would be a situation where, let's say that the company receives some merchandise. Somebody at the loading dock signs for it, checks to make sure that it's all there. They would then pass that received report on to somebody else who would match it up with the actual invoice that basically says, did what they bill us for is what we actually got. Okay. And then it may be a third person, once that's approved by the second person, would actually write the check. and a fourth person would actually sign the check, make sure that the amount of the invoice and what's on the receive report agrees, and the check's written for the same amount so that somebody didn't pad the check. So those are the different types of internal controls that companies use and what management should be monitoring. And so as part of the audit process, I think you said the firm was Sikich. Okay. As part of the process, they would do some testing of those controls. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they would find fraud, you know, because they may do a sample of a certain amount and nothing came up. That would not be unusual.
The city of Dixon is maybe the most famous example in recent memory of municipal fraud.
City clerk, right?
Treasurer, I think it was.
Treasurer, yeah. She used all that money to manage a horse farm.
Bingo. So in that case, treasurer stole nearly $54 million over like 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
The city eventually sued the auditors and got back $40 million of that money. Has that happened elsewhere? I mean, is that something that you've heard of municipalities doing, and is that a possibility here even?
I don't know that it's a possibility here because like I said, I'm not familiar with what Sikich did, but it has been known to happen, particularly when you're talking about financial reporting fraud. Okay, but in this particular case, it's not financial reporting. It is just flat, sounds like misappropriation. Have companies been sued? Absolutely. The one that comes to mind from an industry perspective is Enron. You know, with all that mess in Enron, one of the firms, or their auditing firm, Arthur Anderson, ended up going out of business over it. But it is unusual. It is extremely unusual.
Do municipal officials and the general public have misconceptions, do you think, about what an auditor does for a municipality?
Absolutely. And we talk about it in our classes. And we refer to it as the expectancy gap as to what the public thinks the auditor's job is and what the auditor's job really is. And I think it's, you know, it's a common thought with the public that they expect that auditors are supposed to find fraud, and that isn't the case. If they do, they will say something about it, and they will report it. But that's not what they are charged with. That's not what external auditors are charged with doing.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham with Ed Seif from ISU's Department of Accounting. Sikich, the City of Bloomington's external auditor, issued a statement last week after the Coliseum charges were announced. It said the firm is fully cooperating with law enforcement and the city as it relates to alleged criminal acts during periods we were retained by the city.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, proud to provide community-based cancer care with the help of more than 100 volunteers, many of whom are cancer survivors who are well-equipped to support patients. Information at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Death with Dignity, an exploration with Laura Kennedy. Illinois State University education professor Dr. Deborah McPhee has designed a collaborative model of teacher education she says bridges the gap between theory and practice. She's currently implementing her model as a 3-hour instructional course in the Pekin School District, which is one of ISU's professional development school partners. McPhee tells GLT's John Norton the experience is similar to a lab school environment.
It's a course for pre-service teachers. So they are not teachers yet. They are working toward that. And this is the semester. Before the semester, they student teach. And after student teaching, they go out and find jobs. So this is the semester before that. It's a year-long internship. And I particularly worked with Pekin Professional Development Schools.
So it's an internship these kids go to Pekin schools for?
Yes. Okay. They are in Pekin schools 5 days a week during this whole year.
Mm-hmm.
The first semester, they are also in coursework, but we bring the coursework to the school district. So they don't come to the university for their courses. The courses are embedded in the school district. So that affords them the opportunity to have their courses, but also be very close to the classrooms where they will student teach. The courses were previously taught in a designated room for the university in the school district. And then I reached out to teachers and administrators and asked or worked out where I could teach my course in a primary school, a K-3 primary school.
And what are you teaching them in the Pekin schools?
I'm teaching them literacy methods, how to teach children to read and write and engage with texts. So this is a collaborative model. So my course has a syllabus, but that was negotiated with the teachers in the school based on what they were doing at a particular time during the semester and what their beliefs were. And we read professional texts together with the classroom teachers at the school to support their supporting our teaching interns, right? It's very complex.
Yeah. So how many ISU students typically are in this classroom in Pekin?
So there can be usually from 15 to 25-ish.
Okay, all right.
So you're also trying to mesh schedules, which can be really complex.
Is that?
Yeah. So what a day would look like is I come in for class once a week for 8:30 to 11:30 block of time, a 3-hour block of time. That's the pre-service teacher course, which is in a room in the school. So the first 20 or so minutes of that is time for me to provide the interns with specific instruction. Then we have typically 4 host classrooms in which teachers have agreed to host a small group of interns in their class to observe a particular practice, maybe a read aloud or a guided reading, a small reading group, or a writing lesson or something related to literacy and what the Pekin interns are learning about. That's all pre-planned, who the classrooms will be, what will be observed. The teachers share lesson plans and what the students will be seeing, so the interns are aware of what to expect.
So you're incorporating what the curriculum is going to be in that classroom with what you're teaching in your classroom, too.
Exactly.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So for the next 30 or so minutes, we move out into those classrooms as small groups, and they observe instruction. The teachers will let us know if they need any support or if they want us to work with children while they're in there. But mostly for that first week, they're observing. Then we have organized it so the interns can go back and work with children while the teachers come in small groups to debrief with us. So that's where the research lies. So after the shared instructional experience, the teachers, the interns, myself, and the supervisor, maybe an administrator or a curriculum person, come back to the designated space where class is to debrief what just happened in the classroom together. So that's where the real work of bridging theory and practice comes in during those conversations. And the research that I conducted was research on those actual conversations, those debriefing conversations after the shared experiences.
Well, you've got your model. How did it come to be? What were you seeing that you knew had to change? Something had to give?
So that comes directly from my dissertation work. So that I found in my dissertation, which was a multiple case study on 3 practicing teachers, to examine what influences what they do in their classrooms beyond just what they know about education, but who a person is, how their identity informs the work that they do. And I learned that many teachers, or at least the teachers representative in my sample, and then as a literacy coach, I learned this to be true with other teachers as well, that a lot of the actions we perform in classrooms are not inquired into in terms of, does this match what I believe and what I know about how children learn?
Can you give an example?
Politically, we have had No Child Left Behind, which required scripted programs. And so teachers became accustomed to following a script and maybe didn't pay as close attention to, do I believe the messages that are sent through this curriculum? and through me. And so in education, we are often following a curriculum or a script, sometimes without bringing our whole selves to that and examining that through a critical lens of what theory tells us is best about, you know, how we learn. It's so that need to bring theory and practice together is a particularly important one.
Building on what you just said, how does your model bridge that gap?
So it's in those debriefing conversations.
Okay.
So when we're all at the table. So it's very rare in education that university and school partners are in a space together where they can have deep level conversations about teaching and learning. So we have those shared experiences. We go into a room immediately following that and we debrief what happens. And I'm there to kind of facilitate that. So I can insert questions to help interns and teachers and myself think more deeply about how does the practice that we just observed, is it theoretically sound? In what ways? And how might we improve it for the students who are sitting in the classroom?
Dr. Deborah McPhee, Associate Professor at ISU's College of Education, is our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You're working with the Pekin Community Schools on this. They're a PDS school, as you say, the Professional Development School?
Yes.
Okay. So they are, by definition, they're open to what's going on. What kind of feedback are you getting from the teachers that are already in the school on how this model is working or not working for them?
So I guess my first answer to that question would be you'd need to talk to them.
Mm-hmm. They must be giving you some feedback on
that,
right?
I feel like we are getting great feedback. I can say that because we've been doing this. I've been using this model for 5 years. I consider it a design-based model in that we collect data each year about how it's going, what we can do to improve. And then I use that data along with the teachers to revise it each year. So we modify it to meet the needs of the pre-service teachers as well as the students in the classroom and to meet our own professional development needs as educators.
You've been working on this for a while. Are there refinements that you still need to be made with what you're working on?
Oh, there are always refinements.
Yeah.
It is based in design thinking so that as needed, the design... We adjust the design to meet the needs of the people participating in it. So, for example, some of the research that we found was that when we analyzed the conversations that we were having, a large percentage of those conversations were focused on pedagogy, so teaching strategies, which seems obvious because it's a learning how to teach program. But we wanted to also be focused on our pre-service teacher candidates' knowledge of the learners sitting in front of them, as well as the knowledge of their subject area. So how do I teach reading? Like, what is the content of teaching reading and writing and listening and speaking? So we made some adjustments to align our work with more closely with the Common Core Curriculum Standards to support that content piece. And we adjusted our observation tool, the form that interns fill out as they're observing, to reflect more of their paying attention to students' participation in the lesson as opposed to just what the teacher was doing. So how are the students responding to the teacher's instruction?
Okay. Through this collaborative working with teachers and interns and you, and what are there some specific things that have come back you could talk about that, you know, either the light bulb goes on or, you know, you've learned from each other?
So we spend a lot of time in our class talking about the language of teaching. So how we motivate students and how we keep students motivated, right? Because that's important work in our profession. So oftentimes the interns praise students. And that was one of the things we found in our analysis of the conversation. There was a lot of praise and encouragement. So praise in terms of good job, mm-hmm. and then moving on to another student. So the teachers in Pekin had been working on accountable talk type things, and they've been studying language in their own classrooms and reading about growth mindset. The teachers were really working on not just empty praise, but very specific praise. So the way that you did this, mm-hmm. you know, the way that you added details to this sentence makes the sentence much better.
As opposed to, nice job, little Johnny.
Right, exactly. So the teachers brought that to the attention of the interns, and we all worked on giving more specific feedback to students beyond just praise.
Illinois State University College of Education Professor Dr. Deborah McPhee speaking with GLT's John Norton about the collaborative teaching model she designed to help bridge the gap between teacher education, theory, and practice. You can read more about the model in the latest Redbird Scholar magazine.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
My favorite program on GLT is Sound Ideas. Hi, I'm Lauren Lacey, a GLT contributing listener. GLT's Sound Ideas delivers the news I need with a local focus, from in-depth interviews with the community leaders to reviews of local theater. I can count on Sound Ideas to explore community-wide issues and help me feel part of the community. The GLT Fund Drive is underway. Help pay for Sound Ideas and everything GLT does with your contribution now. Click on Donate at WGLT.org.
The only way GLT can pay for the programs you depend on is with listener financial support. That's why we're asking for your help today, particularly those of you who have never contributed before. Make the decision right now to give what you can to help meet the program budget. Keep the GLT and NPR programs right where you want them to be with your first-time contribution at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Illinois Politics Roundtable. An advocate for end-of-life options and dying with dignity legislation is appearing at Illinois State University to share the story of his wife's courage and determination in the face of an incurable disease. And he relates how he's carrying on her fight state by state. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
In November 2014, 29-year-old Brittany Maynard died from a brain tumor. Her husband, Dan Diaz, at her side. Her story became national news when Brittany, facing certain death, chose to pursue a gentle dying process, and the couple moved from California to Oregon, one of seven states where medical aid in dying is allowed. Diaz made a promise to his wife to help others facing similar situations by advocating for end-of-life options and helping to spur legislation allowing terminally ill individuals to also have the option of a gentle dying process. Diaz shares his wife's journey to help put a human story at the heart of a difficult issue. He says he wants people to understand Brittany and her struggle, and he also hopes they appreciate her spirit. Diaz says his wife had an adventurous soul.
She loved being outdoors. Brittany had summited Kilimanjaro in Africa, Cotopaxi in Ecuador. So as far as even some of the tall peaks on the planet, it's what she enjoyed doing.
When you received the news of the diagnosis of the terminal brain cancer, how did Brittany react to that?
We were devastated. We were in the process of looking to start a family. We both wanted to have two or three kids. Brittany wanted two. I said three, maybe four. We figured we would iron that out when the time was right. But yes, we're at the beginning of our marriage, and had settled into our home together that we had bought just a year before. And then we discovered on New Year's Day that Brittany had that brain tumor and that there was no cure. So it was a horrible blow to her to hear that she had 3 to 5 years to live. And after enduring an 8-hour brain surgery and we're researching every clinical trial that might extend her life, at the first follow-up MRI, that's when the tumor showed signs that it was growing aggressively. And at that point, they tell Brittany, well, that's indicative of a glioblastoma multiforme, the most aggressive type of brain cancer. And that's when they informed us that most likely she only had 6 months left to live. So it was devastating, that whole sequence and how that unfolded. She pursued, and we had to leave our home in California, move to Oregon, so that she would have the option of medical aid in dying if it were to become necessary for her. You know, the hope is that hospice and palliative care can keep a person comfortable at end of life, and in most cases, it absolutely can. And so Brittany just wanted that option of having that medication. Her focus was on living life as long as she possibly could, but knowing that if the suffering gets to a point where modern medicine cannot keep her from those seizures, from suffering a stroke, from going blind, from becoming paralyzed, that, you know, Brittany would have that option for the gentle dying process. So, you know, her determination was always to live.
Well, she also had a measuring of control in that she decided to make a video campaign to support death with dignity.
I refuse to subject myself and my family to purposeless, prolonged pain and suffering at the hands of an incurable disease. Death with dignity laws authorize the medical practice of aid in dying. They give mentally competent, terminally ill adults the option to request life-ending medication that they can choose to ingest if their dying process becomes unbearable. The freedom of this patient right is choice.
The reason that she spoke up and the reason that she decided to lend her voice to this was because she thought it was a huge injustice that why did we have to leave our home in California? If we stay in California, she potentially suffers an agonizing dying process. But if we move to Oregon, she now has this option. She thought that was grossly unfair that because of the state we live in, that she wouldn't have this option. So she spoke up and nowhere did we think it would catch on like it did. That just speaks to Brittany's personality, her determination to speak up for those that maybe don't have a voice. So as soon as it was October 6th of 2014 that video was released, and you know, within a short amount of time, 12 million hits on YouTube, and all of a sudden people knew about Brittany Menard and what she was going through. So it certainly did make an impact and change now the conversation we have about end-of-life options.
You're working in order to make sure other states follow the example of Oregon. What are your biggest challenges in getting death with dignity legislation adopted in the states? You're doing this in a state-by-state manner.
That's correct. So, yes, this is a state issue. It's not a federal issue. And so before Brittany died, there were 4 states, Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Montana, that had this end-of-life option of medical aid in dying. And now since Brittany's death, we've passed it in California, Colorado, and the District of Columbia. It is the promise that I made to Brittany to help move legislation forward so that nobody else would ever have to leave their home like we did. The opposition primarily comes from the church, the Catholic Church. I frustrate them because I'm Catholic. I was an altar boy. I went to Catholic school. The interesting part, though, is while the leadership of the church, the official position, is that of being opposed to medical aid in dying, support for medical aid in dying nationwide amongst Catholics is 70%. So, and in state by state, it varies. I was just in Massachusetts last week,
yeah,
working on legislation there. Support amongst Catholics there, 64%. Support amongst Catholics in California was just a little over 60%. But nationwide, the number is 70%.
Well, Dan, as you say, you're a Catholic. When it was first proposed by Brittany that she could take this option at her end of life to end her own life with the drugs, what was your reaction? Were you immediately on board, or did you resist?
Yeah, that was a conversation. Brittany, in one of the classes that she had taken in college, she had done or knew about Borgen's Death with Dignity Law. I hadn't heard about it. In hearing what Brittany was saying and then understanding what she was talking about, I quickly recognized, wait a second, if I was in her shoes, if I was the one who had the brain tumor, I'd be saying the exact same thing to her, that I'm going to continue fighting and do everything I can to battle against this brain tumor, but we can wage that battle from Oregon, because at least there, well, I'll have this option of that gentle dying process. Very quickly, I understood the logic and the reasoning behind it. And then at that point, you know, my job is, as Brittany's husband, is the person that, you know, here's the person I love the most in the world, is to be supportive and say, well, then if moving to Oregon is what we have to do, then that's what we're doing.
Well, Dan, just last month you were in Massachusetts, as you just said, at a hearing. And they had a couple of doctors there who were actually testifying against the bill. There was one, Dr. William Toffler, who suggested there would be perhaps some subtle pressure to comply with state-sanctioned suicide. And I want to know, what is your take on the medical profession's end of things, who are pushing back and saying, no, we don't need this kind of legislation?
The physician you just mentioned, one of his colleagues at Oregon Health and Science University, was Brittany's physician. And so for Dr. Toffler, who is opposed to this, that's fine. He is in the minority. 29% of physicians oppose medical aid in dying, whereas the majority, 57%, are supportive and agree that a terminally ill individual should have this option. So he is entitled to his opinion, but therein lies the strength of this law, is that it is an option. It is an option that the patient has to pursue, apply for, qualify for, and finally be granted that prescription. But it is also optional for physicians. So if there's a doctor who isn't quite on board or doesn't feel that he wants to participate, then they simply do not participate in it. That's the strength of this legislation. Regarding one thing that you mentioned, the terminology, because to me that's very important. Medical aid in dying is the term that I use because it's appropriate, it's accurate. It was that medication that aided Brittany in her dying process, those, you know, how her final few days played out on this green earth. She had that control. The term suicide, physician-assisted suicide, those are neither applicable nor appropriate. And the reason is follows. A person who is suicidal is a person who wants to die. Brittany wanted to live. So right away we're talking about two completely different subsets of the population. A person who is suicidal is somebody who is depressed, despondent, making irrational decisions. Brittany was none of those things, and everyone on her medical team would attest to that. That for her, medical aid in dying, this option that she had, afforded her that little bit of control, but there is nothing suicidal about her. And so that term suicide, the opponents, they use it to great effect because that is a very charged word. That term suicide right away conjures this notion of an individual who is desperate, who they're despondent, they don't know what they're doing. And that's not at all what a terminally ill individual is going through. Brittany Menard, Christy O'Donnell, Emily Rose Olvera, Leslie Hollis, I have dozens of examples of individuals who everything about them is trying to live. And so that term suicide, I think once it's explained and people reflect on that, they recognize that that label is not appropriate and we shouldn't be assigning that charged word to this medical practice.
In your work with regards to politicians and trying to get legislature moved through state houses, you had a situation in Colorado where you spoke with a politician recently who said he was personally for the idea of medical aid in dying, but he voted against it because it was for political reasons. Do you find that really frustrating?
I do. It's interesting how many staunch conservatives have shared with me that they are personally supportive of this. The one that you mentioned in Colorado, there was another in Utah. And so this gentleman, senator, who was Mormon, and you know, we had a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking to him. He was sharing with me the situation where his own mother, who had recently died, and he said that he wished that his mother had had this option. Now, he recognizes that privately he and I can have this conversation, but publicly for him to vote in support, whether it was the legislator in Utah or the one in Colorado, that they would get pushback from their caucus. That is extremely frustrating. It's something that our elected officials need to start representing the will of their constituents and not just toe the party line. And I think that's what Brittany's story does, though. The benefit of sharing her story is that people recognize this is not a partisan issue. We're talking about life, and eventually we all, every single one of us, will die. We cannot come at this issue from a partisan standpoint. This has to be something that we look at the merits of this legislation, the protections that are in place, and state by state, my hope is that we'll see more legislation passed in more states.
That's Dan Diaz. He's scheduled to present the talk, Brittany Maynard's Story of Living Life, End of Life Options and Care, tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Old Main Room of the Illinois State University Bone Student Center. The talk is free and open to the public. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Dan Diaz's appearance is sponsored by the ISU Department of Psychology. While in Bloomington Normal, Diaz is scheduled to meet and talk up close with professionals and trainees who are directly involved with end-of-life decisions and care. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There is more talk about a primary contest for Republican Governor Bruce Rauner in the wake of what his critics say was a broken promise to veto a Medicaid funding bill that would cover abortion for poor women. But this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable also focuses on the reaction to the mass killing in Las Vegas. Panelists this week are Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, moderator Sean Crawford, and IPR's Brian Mackey.
There was a couple of political reactions to this in Illinois, and, you know, obviously Your mind first with something like this goes to the victims and the human tragedy. But since this is a political show, it's worth talking about how, you know, legislators are reacting to this, I think. And we heard out of Washington, both Republicans and Democrats saying that they wanted to take a look at these so-called bump stocks. This is a device that you can attach to the back of a semi-automatic rifle, and it makes it operate almost as a fully automatic rifle, and that's what allowed the gunman in Las Vegas to fire so rapidly. It's interesting to note that the way the Republicans want to do it is through the regulatory process. They want the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, to reevaluate a decision that said these things were not illegal from a few years ago. And they're even saying, you know, under the previous administration. So they're kind of tying it to the Obama administration. The Democrats want to pass legislation. The Senate Democrats have, many of them have signed on to a bill that would outlaw these things, and they're looking at other bills. Here in Illinois, State Representative Marty Moylan, a Democrat from Des Plaines, has introduced a bill that not only would ban these bump stocks, but would also go much further. And it's basically a long list of things that gun control advocates have been pushing for a long time, banning high-capacity magazines. Most semi-automatic weapons would have to be registered, and new ones could not be sold in Illinois. It's a much broader look. What I don't really have a good sense of yet is this something where there's an incident, you want to be seen as doing something, and so you put a big bill out there, and you know, you're not necessarily going to fight tooth and nail for it in the upcoming veto session, or is this something where we could really see a real fight in the state level? I do think it's worth noting that in Illinois, both Democratic caucuses in the House and Senate have lost some of their key top pro-gun people in recent years. State Senator Gary Forby, State Representative Phelps stepped down. State Representative John Bradley was defeated. And so those caucuses are more liberal and probably they still have majorities and they're probably more amenable to gun regulation.
All right. Time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's go to you first.
Well, we've now got 3 months in of the higher income tax rates, and not surprisingly, the state's coffers are doing better. The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with its most recent update through the month of September, and it shows that our general funds, the main checkbook account, was up roughly $1.5 billion from this time a year ago, close to a 22% increase.
All right. Greg Hines?
I want to pick up on a point Brian made. Mike Madvin, by all accounts, kind of had to be talked into going along with an income tax increase. He was worried about the impact of his folks. But all this furor over the soda pop tax up in Cook County has taken the spotlight off of Madigan and put it right on that. We're not talking about your state representative voted for that terrible income tax increase. Now we're talking about Tony Prequickle and the soda pop tax. Madigan ought to send her a dozen roses and send every member of the Board of Commissioners a case of scotch because the monkey's kind of off his back, at least so far.
Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR's Brian Mackey make up the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Find the stories and interviews you heard today, thanks to Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton, at our website. That is also where you can find the full SI podcast. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The website is WGLT.org. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.